KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and a visiting research collaborator at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm very excited to start off 2016 and starting off the winter quarter on KZSU's schedule in the winter with Nato Thompson, author of the book Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century. I came across Nato's work doing my own research in space involving activism around lawmaking and IP, and his book is a very interesting corollary not only to that work but to the broader topics that we focused on Hearsay Culture in the last several years, everything from the nature of negotiation and power in our society to, more specifically, the use of art and communications as a source of power and influence in society, and even down to the question of what it means to move information around the internet. Seeing Power is written at a level that I think is highly accessible, not just for people that would be experts in this field, but for people that really want to think about the nature of art in 2015-2016. And therefore, we're going to be able to take a very deep dive into the question of what the role of art is in our social fabric today, how art can influence world events, given all of the other competing areas that art has to deal with in terms of time and influence, the role of privatization, the role of ambiguity, which I found fascinating as someone who teaches contracts to first-year law students. And so we're going to dig pretty deeply into these various areas in Nato Thompson's book, Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century, published last year by Melville House. By way of brief background, Nato Thompson joined Creative Time, and we're going to talk about what that entity is, in 2007. He's organized a number of interesting art and activism projects over the last several years, and he has been writing about these issues in everything from industry publications like Book Forum to broader and wider outlets like Huffington Post. In 2005, he received the Art Journal Award for Distinguished Writing. He also has been, I think, very active in focusing on the role of art in power in a variety of colloquial and informal contexts. And so I'm very excited to have him on the show today. We are recording this show on January 11th, 2016, for airing this week on Hearsay Culture schedule. Nato is joining us via Skype from his home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Nato, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
A real pleasure to be here.
So, Nato, let me start you off with a question I ask most of my authors. Tell us a bit more about your background and what Creative Time is.
Sure. So, you know, I work as a curator in a public arts organization based in New York City called Creative Time. And to be kind of straightforward about it, most people think of public art as art that's not in a museum or gallery, but outside, perhaps in a park or some central plaza. In a general sense, I put together projects in that regards. It gets more complex, but my job is basically to work with artists to make their dreams happen in space, in the urban space. And I've been doing curating for quite some time before joining Creative Time in 2007. I worked at a museum in Massachusetts called MassMoCA, the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. And previous to that, I was just more of an activist person interested in art through my undergrad and graduate years, kind of popping around this wonderful country of ours.
And so are you yourself are an artist?
No.
Okay, that's the follow-up question. Go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, sure. I can't make anything. I mean, my drawings are awful. I guess my art, if anything, is conviviality and thinking. I've always grown up with appreciating somewhat crazy people and what they can offer society. So, you know, that skill set basically only finds one home, and that's the arts. So, that's not true. So, I think it fits a lot of categories.
Well, I was going to say, so in light of that, do you consider yourself in any way an art critic, or is that a separate beast as far as you're concerned?
No, I don't think I'd like to think through art. So I suppose in some ways, yes. But I'm a little hesitant towards the thumbs up, thumbs down style, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. which I think comes with the critic role. But certainly I'm actively interested in the interpreting art, I suppose.
So and that gets us, I think, right into the title. You know, as someone, as I mentioned, who teaches contracts, I think words are important, and I take words seriously. And so the title of your book is Seeing Power, the subtitle Art and Activism in the 21st Century. I'm not going to assume that seeing power is meaning in this context is self-evident. Rather, I will ask you, what does that mean?
Well, it's meant to be somewhat of a double entendre, but certainly there is the power of seeing. So that is to say the power of vision and what that means for us as a very visual society. But I would also say it's about literally seeing power. That is to say, and that'll get a little more complex, but in a more straightforward way, I would say that power operates in a multitude of fashions, as you well know and your listeners do. And our ability to see it is also part of our cultural legacy and current manifestations of who we are. And I argue throughout the book that we have increasingly become both sophisticated at seeing power, as well as, I would also argue, somewhat paranoiac in terms of being haunted that power is always operating everywhere.
So what is, and again, and it is more complex, and I do want to dig into it, but I'll ask this top-level question as well. How do you define power for purposes of this book?
Well, I think it's a really complex phenomena, and not to get too theoretical.
No, feel free. That's actually what we do on this show, so get as theoretical as you would like.
Yeah, well, just to say it's a little Foucauldian in that sense. I do think power ultimately means the thing that gets its way. And sometimes I would say that you can certainly read that from a Marxist perspective, that power is bound up with capital or the capacity to leverage finance to get what you want. But there's other forms of power, of course, and I'm not the kind of Marxist that believes that economics determines the entirety of the world. I think there is patriarchal power, there is white power, there is gender power. There's many forms of power that iterate out that we're familiar with. But I do think that it's important when we think about ethics and justice to be aware of these kind of battles when we're thinking about not only art, but all, you know, understanding power is the way we can understand most conditions as they happen. I know that you study law, and certainly power is a great way to understand law.
And I definitely attempt to make my students aware of that power and its limitations early on in their legal education. Why write this book now? What's going on in 2015, 2016 that it compelled you to write this book?
I'm not really, just to say, as much as I am in art, for me, art is a way to get at complex discussions around meaning. And I really believe that this, for me, art is not all that different from education in so much as a space of exploration of thinking. And, we live in an age in the art, in the arts, you could say, I always have this kind of thing I say, which is the arts kind of have won, but they also lost. And what I mean by they have won is the cultural manipulation, using symbols, using culture in a way that evokes feelings in people, has massively won. It's a big part of our lives. It's not just television. It's not just radio. It's not just film. It's not just the internet. It's also just the way that people act. It's Twitter. It's Instagram. These kind of vehicles by which we symbolically produce the world around us is a mega industry, right? But that said, that kind of field of operation that even 150 years ago would be considered the terrain of art. The terrain of art now is much, what people typically think of it, is much smaller than that other thing. But that other thing of cultural manipulation, I would say, is in fact deeply influential in how you can understand the world around us. And I'm really interested in teasing how that world is affecting us, because I think there are deeply, deeply political implications for it in terms of justice, in terms of understanding why things are the way they are. So for me, it's a political project, to be short about it. It is a political project that cultural understanding the ways in which culture is being deployed in our current age has political ramifications. And in understanding it, hopefully you can start working on making it more equitable and just.
And I think you just said what I wanted to follow up on. How is art a function or an influencer of justice in your view?
Well, you know, it's art itself is like a tool, you know, so I would just say it is a powerful tool, and it's and a wild tool. And so it's really hard to make any kind of ethical claims on it, like a hammer, if you will. You can use a hammer to do many things. So it's more about understanding the tool and how different people are using it. And certainly the tool of symbolic manipulation is a deeply powerful tool. Ask Donald Trump, you know, but you can also ask Red Bull. You can also ask your everyday artist. You can also ask any 14-year-old on their Instagram account.
So we're chatting with Nate O'Thompson, author of the book Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century on Hearsay Culture and KZSU. You know, I've asked you about power. I've asked you about art, just again to be clear. And this is as you alluded to, Nate, this is what happens when lawyers interview people. We want to know what you mean, but I'll ask you just to be clear. So activism in the context of your book means?
There's two definitions to that. One is an action, and then I think the other is a kind of cultural subgroup. And they're different. You know, certainly the action, I would say, can be defined roughly as people that want to change things in the world politically, whatever, or changing things in the world politically, the action. I guess the cultural subgroup are the people that would define themselves as activists. Now, they're not exactly the same thing, and it's important to bear that in mind, because I would also say that people that label themselves activists do so for various sociological reasons, and you certainly can get things done in the world without labeling yourself an activist, and simultaneously, you can call yourself an activist and not get anything done in the world. So they don't necessarily imply the same thing, but they are related terms.
So you use the phrase in the book, and I think this gets into kind of a little bit deeper dive, and perhaps you could share a few examples of the kinds of situations that you consider to be emblematic of the issues you're focusing on. But you use the phrase social aesthetics in the book repeatedly, and I think it's one, at least as I read the book, that kind of frames your critique of the nature of power via art. What is social aesthetics, and perhaps through that answer you could share a couple of examples of the kinds of situations upon which you focus?
So maybe I can start with an example, because it's certainly I think the book is extraordinarily helped by examples, because it can all feel very abstract, of course.
Yes.
So in 2009 I worked with an artist named Jeremy Deller on a project called It Is What It Is: Conversations About Iraq. This is during the Iraq War, of course, the tail end. And the project was pretty simple, which was to get a car that had been blown up in a marketplace bombing in Baghdad on a street called Al-Mutanabi Street. And we had that brought to the United States in a complex journey. And then we traveled it across the United States on the back of an RV, and traveling with the car, this kind of rusted, hulking mess of a car, was a U.S. soldier who'd done two tours in Iraq, and then an Iraqi asylee who served as a translator in Iraq and was an artist. So you had an Iraqi citizen and you had a U.S. soldier with very different experiences and opinions. And we traveled to different towns, the artist, myself, and these two folks and a few other crew, and basically, the project was to have conversations. In a simple sense, it was a way to get the news about what was happening in Iraq. You know, in the United States, we are often experiencing wars that we're directly involved in and have no intimate relationships whatsoever with. So it was a way to get out of the mediated space and to have conversations firsthand with people. And so that project, just to say, and the conversation was the art, if you will. So we had anywhere from ex-military who've been over there, veterans who are all of 20 years old, come and talk. We had people whose families were over there. We had Iraqis. We had all kinds of different folks come and basically have conversations in public about what they were thinking about, asking questions, curious. And it actually opened up the kind of political space of this project in a profound way. But that kind of social nature of it is what we might describe as social aesthetics. That is, most traditional understandings of art is it's a painting on the wall, or it is a maybe a sculpture. But here the social aspects of this produce what you might call social aesthetics.
Now, it's interesting to use that as an example, because this kind of frames this question of art as activism today, because, you know, clearly to get structural about this, right, if you're dealing with a car that's been destroyed in a bomb, of course, unless the bombing itself was staged, right, you're taking the result of a, you know, horrific act and then converting it to something different. And from an activist standpoint, right, that makes a lot of sense, right? And I, as you're telling that story, I was thinking of other kinds of visuals, like the national debt clock that Concord Coalition, that focuses on deficit reduction, uses to basically put on the same kind of flatbed a big clock that shows a number increasing exponentially to show how much debt the U.S. has. It's a very stark visual. But the point is this, right? That is not something that was created intentionally as art, but something that's being used or transformed into, right, a form of art. Is that the activism aspect of art that is the focus of your work, as opposed to, like I said, right, which you, I guess you could do, right, putting a car in the desert and blowing it up and saying, now we're going to use that? Is there meaning in that difference in, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think just to say, there's a few parts of this. You know, I would say that having the actual car from Iraq itself makes it more meaningful in a sense. It has an aura of authenticity, if you will. So you certainly, when you know, and it is almost like a body being brought over. And I would say the art part of it, frankly, and it's funny because the activist part's a little more complex for me, but the art part of this, I would say, is the fact that it's completely open-ended politically, right? It's not, I mean, not only does it have sculptural elements and performative elements, and it's also organized by an artist, and it doesn't fit with any typical canon. But what's interesting about it is the point is unclear. Unlike the deficit clock, right? Mm-hmm. Which you understand the point, it's pointing out the deficit, right? This one, as much as it tells you what's happening in Iraq, it's still quite open-ended what that actually means, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's pretty, and I think that open-ended quality makes it very artistic or even pedagogical, because it's not telling you, hey, the Iraq war is bad per se, and it's not telling you or hey, you know, hooray the troops, support the troops. It's unclear what this project wants. I think that ambiguity is what makes it a much more complex art project. And also on a kind of anecdotal level, we had the toughest time on the road from left-wing activist groups who felt that this was no time to be ambiguous about the Iraq war, that in fact it was critical that people were resistant to the Iraq war, and really, like, this project should be much more about condemning the war itself, which was certainly not the purpose of this project, but I was sympathetic to their concerns, of course.
Well, and the ambiguity angle that you've identified, I think, in a very unique and fascinating way in the book, is something I want to come to shortly. But before we get there, I want to follow up on that point with a related question. Your stated goal at the end of the book is to inform readers about their, and quoting you, their capacity and resources to construct worlds collectively. Which I think is certainly an interesting goal, and I'm curious if you could explain how examples like the Iraq car example helps inform readers to understand that power.
Well, you know, there's a few parts to the book, and so, you know, that particular example is tricky to explain, that because, of course, in that situation, you have an artist who's actually quite well known, who was commissioned by my organization, Creative Time. So that this is, in just to say in simple terms, this is a project that's not so far outside the art world infrastructure. So I think for a young artist, they might look at that and say, well, yeah, you have all this economic support, easy for you to say. I would say, however, that in the book, there are also examples of much more, I'd say, less financed or scrappy institutional levels, which I am an ardent supporter of. And I really try to situate this whole book within what I call an infrastructure of resonance. But just to say, understanding that infrastructure, meaning buildings, resources, capital in physical space, are an important way in which power is derived. And you don't have to necessarily, and this is applicable to many fields, because of course, even in publishing, you don't necessarily need to knock on the door of a Random House in order to make a book, right? You can also start your own blog. You can, just using a publishing app corollary. But there's many ways you can produce your own worlds. And I think in the arts as well, you don't necessarily have to get into a museum. When I lived in Chicago, many people just opened up their apartments, put art on the walls, and had meetings, and then they had their own art space. And I strongly encourage, and I ardently believe in the power of that way of working. Perhaps it's because I lived for some time in the Bay Area in Berkeley and got to see firsthand the power of student co-ops and pirate radio and kind of a spirit of do-it-yourself infrastructure that I found extraordinarily politically effective. But that's what I mean when I say create your own worlds, is to literally go out there and build your own infrastructures. And there is a lot of power in that. And simultaneously, and then I'll shut up, but I also think it's important to take over the big infrastructures and to not be naive about the power of big infrastructure as well, that there is a multi-tiered way of approaching these things, is to start your own infrastructures and simultaneously work towards getting into or dealing with the mega infrastructures, because they are certainly big players.
And we're chatting with Nato Thompson, author of the book Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century. I want to come back to your critique of the challenge of building these capacities and resources. Yeah, and hearsay culture has focused numerous times over the last 10 years on issues involving the commons and collective cultural production and the like. But you've alluded to it a couple of times. I think it's a good time to dive into it a bit before we take a break, which is the role of the city in your conception of art and activism. As I was reading your book, I was thinking about the writings of utopian theorists like Lewis Mumford and others who attempted to build that perfect city, that or to theorize that perfect city that would allow for all of these social goods, including art, but justice and equality to thrive. What is the role of the city in your conception of art and activism today, particularly keeping in mind, right, the malleability of infrastructure on the internet versus the lack of malleability in things like roads and buildings?
Sure. Well, just to say that the history of a spatial way of understanding the world, and people that have really influenced me, frankly, are much more contemporary, like Mike Davis, Edward Soja, Henri Lefebvre, a kind of spatial reading of the world. Why am I spacing his name? I'll get to him. Anyways, but the reason I think understanding cities is productive is, A, sometimes theory can be what I call textual. Many people do. A lot of postmodern theory, I think, left the impression that the world was a book that needed to be read, right? That the problems were linguistic or semiotic, and that we just needed to understand the world through language, if you will. But understanding the world through space, I think, has a lot of power, because A, cities, let's just talk about a street corner. If you talk about an art project on a street corner, not only can you situate that art project in its historical language, you can situate it in the history of that particular site. And that, to go to law, sites have building codes, sites are owned, sites have histories. There are ways to think through the power of a space that also gets to the actual written laws and forms of finance that are situating that. And so I find it very useful because we can get a little more specific about what we're talking about when we look through the world in terms of space, in terms of private property, and that, you know, we do, and I think it's also really important with abstract things like art or making meaning. Space is useful because it suddenly makes concrete the world we experience, that you move through space to go to a job, that that job is in a building, that you know, that there are places, if you're in manufacturing, that distribute and produce goods. So you can actually understand these ideas as situated in the world. And for me, I find it extremely helpful in very abstract conversations to situate them in the world we live in. And that also has implications, obviously, politically, because you can solve some of these things, right? That, in fact, it becomes a little more solvable when you solve things in space. There are housing codes. There are legal precedents. There are ways in which we can think through the world in space that has a history of solutions. Whereas sometimes when it's just abstract, talking about art or meaning, it's unclear how anything is going to get solved in that regard.
We're chatting with Nate O'Thompson, author of the book Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, and I thank you for listening to the show regularly, particularly if you've been listening for the past almost coming up on 11 years, KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or click on Donate to KZSU on our webpage. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen not only to Hearsay Culture but to the station. You know, before we, Nate, turn a bit to, and you alluded to it as well, the issue of resources and privatization and how that influences one's ability to be an activist. I guess I'd be remiss in not noting today on January 11th that the news came overnight involving the death of David Bowie, who, to me, at any rate, might very well in a lot of ways exemplify exactly what you're referring to with regard to, you know, the malleability of space and structure as of course, a musician, given his various iterations over the course of his career, where he always seemed to be remaking himself to not only stay current, but to really resonate with audiences. Recognizing, of course, that this is, you know, it's news in the sense that I don't think maybe a lot of people didn't know he was sick or what have you. But I'm curious if you have a visceral or gut reaction to, particularly, again, given the timing of our interview, David Bowie as a reflection of that kind of use of space to influence events. Because clearly, while Bowie would not be considered, I think, by most people, one of the primary examples of activist artists, when, you know, his Ziggy Stardust and Major Tom material really did in a lot of ways cause people to think about, and now space in a different sense, of course, outer space, but also just our role as humans. So that's a somewhat convoluted question, but I'm curious if you have a reaction to it.
You know, we live in an interesting time, and maybe this will get to the kind of, I think, I guess the of the two minds feeling that is our age. And I mean that in so much as I have deep misgivings and adoration. Maybe it's because I have such adoration for music and its stars. Music is a powerful force in our society, obviously. Almost strangely, undeservedly so. But it is a very powerful force. And certainly David Bowie is a brilliant, amazing, inspiring artist who played with sexuality and mythology and dreams, and also in many minds navigated the ever fickle worlds of subculture with great grace and power. That said, you know, there is also the peculiar situation where, you know, these ideas of co-optation, not that he was co-opted, but that the fact that, you know, we live in a world where everyone, you know, just to say, there's a writer named Thomas Frank who has written about this for quite some time in a book called, I don't know when it was published, but called Commodify Your Dissent. But we live in an age where capitalism itself is the ultimate rebel, right? And that power is always representing itself as the outsider and the person that's kicking against the man. and Coca-Cola will do advertisements of people in their cubicles throwing up their papers and saying, I can't take it anymore, and running outside and dancing with a Coca-Cola in their hands. And so in some ways, I would say that the spirit of subculture is always tainted by its embrace by power. That said, it doesn't make any sense to turn on the dreamers who inspire this very process. Of course, David Bowie's a genius, and it seems odd to ever besmirch him. But we are in this kind of odd state where it's hard to actually believe that pushes against the system when the system itself adores these maneuvers.
It is this privatization of the creative process that I think is one that you bring out in the book, and I think is worthy of far more discussion than it gets. So I want to turn to that and ask you about more, even more specifically, about the role of privatization on art and activism, and this notion that you point out in the book, but I'd like to hear more about the privatization of time.
The privatization of time. There's something I'd like to say that's perhaps kind of useful, which is we do know about global warming, of course, at this point, and that is to say that manufacturing produces goods, that there is this massive industrial growth that has literally environmental effects that are warming the planet. We understand that in terms of raw materials. But I would also say that the cultural production, that is to say, the constant manipulating of things that are meaningful to us to sell things, right? And this is a massive industry that's been going on in full tilt for 60 plus years, has its own greenhouse gas emission, if you will, as an allegory. But that we increasingly become educated that the things we love will inevitably turn against us or be used for ulterior purposes. Now, this isn't getting to the time thing. I will get there. Mm-hmm. But it's important because this process of privatization has emotional and psychological and linguistic results. That is to say that we increasingly become distrustful of the things that we adore publicly. David Bowie was one example, but certainly there are, not that I distrust David Bowie, quote unquote, but you get the point that there are, you know, whether it's your favorite band in high school, whether it's particularly in activism, if there's any kind of political figure you love and then they're turned, you become very distrustful of the world. And so paranoia becomes this de facto emotion. And I'd say that because it's useful when you understand that why people like Trump do so well, but also why the political mood in this country is basically one of deep distrust of all things, right? That in fact, distrust is a unifying ethos of this country. Forget right wing, left wing, just paranoia that someone's out to get you tends to unite most people now. I think that's why sports do so well, because it's a little more clear. Nevertheless, in terms of the privatization of time, these things also coalesce in terms of our own understanding of day-to-day activities. That, you know, as opposed to just the capitalism acting on us from outside, you know, in terms of marketing and advertising, people become their own brands, you know, in some peculiar way. Social networking is useful because everyone communicates, but it's also distilling a certain kind of you become the market itself, that you literally represent yourself online as a brand, that your own social relationships are certainly in some ways extensions of your cultural value. And that kind of way in which this logic works its way into the very innermost parts of our being consume us at all times, right? And so suddenly space and time are collapsing. And not to say, and it sounds so abstract, I don't want to get there, but we can feel it, of course, right? Certainly in the most obvious sense, the workday doesn't make any sense for anyone in a information economy matter, because you are always on your phone and you are always working. But so too is this kind of space by which everything wants something for you. And so I would say, just to say that those kind of forces produce a new sense of reality. And so not only do you find people looking for vacations, say, in open land, or like spaces, space that is open, but literally also time that is open, places without your phone, places without your computer. Suddenly temporal freedom becomes a need, a much deeper need. And it also becomes a tool for working. So it's a dynamic.
So there's a lot there. And let me see if I can, I don't want to distill is the wrong word. Let me see if I can focus us in a particular direction. If I understand your response correctly, privatization of time is similar to that co-option function to which you previously referred, and I think you just alluded to that your time as an individual is no longer yours. If I'm right in your understanding that critique, then let me backtrack to the question and say, if that's right, then what is the impact of that on art and its ability to influence power today? Is the co-option that artists become neutralized in the way that you alluded to, although disclaimed, with a person like Bowie, that one's success by definition makes them less authentic and then therefore less capable of influencing things, or is it something different?
So, you know, because the nature of power is always changing, it produces new opportunities for things to be fresh and interesting. And so on the notion of time, for example, certainly, well, let me do a spatial corollary and then we'll do a temporal one. So I work in public art, right? And we do projects outside in the city. And so I've said this to our board, but, you know, for example, we did a project with this artist, Kara Walker. It was in the Domino Sugar Factory that was about to get closed down. It was a giant sphinx that was kind of a hybrid of a sphinx, an African-American woman, that was all made of sugar, about four stories tall. And the public was allowed to come in, and it was thinking about slavery and sugar production. Anyways, and it was free for the public to see. Well, public, and it was a huge success. Lines, lines, lines. But it's also interesting because public art, at least if we're working at Creative Time in New York City, benefits greatly, strangely enough, from the fact that most experiences in public life are deeply coercive, right? That, in fact, if you go outside and someone is, like, yelling at you, they're either wanting to convert you to some religion, they're trying to sell you a cell phone, they want to put a Red Bull in your hand, right? That there's some kind of ulterior motive. They want you to sign some petition. But the experience where something doesn't want anything from you, right, is very rare. And so suddenly those that fill that need become deeply inspiring and interesting to people. The same can be said for time, which is to say that all of a sudden, if there is a space, a place that allows time where you're not completely being eaten up or wanted, right, that you can get out of the kind of rapid, fast movement, now we could call them almost like a time version of a spa, right? That all of a sudden time expands for you. And so artists are very aware of these things, you know, and can use that, like produce spaces where time extends for people, that it is, you know, either meditative or longer term, or some way of stretching time so people are kind of free from the minute uses of their time. Think of it like a material. So suddenly these kind of open-ended spaces that are rare in our lives become deeply interesting for artists to use.
We're chatting with Nato Thompson, author of the book Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. All right, so Nato, I do want to come back to this issue of ambiguity and of meaning being unclear. You've alluded to it already, that there is power in ambiguity, and the role of that ambiguity in art and power is precisely, if it can be put in a precise way, what is the benefit of ambiguity from the perspective of the artist and from the perspective of the viewer?
So, like most things of my book, like ambiguity is a tool, right? So I'll go into that, but maybe this is what's somewhat not frustrating, but I don't think of the world as like this is good or this is bad, but more these are tools that are just deployed in certain circumstances and have these results.
Right, and let me interrupt you. Just say I don't mean benefit in a normative sense. I mean it more. Maybe I'll rephrase the question so I don't mislead you. As an artist and as a viewer, why would we want to see or identify ambiguity in a work?
Sure, of course. So the first thing I will say is I think that for an artist, I think that there's a political motivation in being an artist, and that is through ambiguity. And what I mean by that is that I think that the idea that you can make something that is hard to understand or that forces you to – that doesn't have a clear interpretation, that is ambiguous, that either is evocative emotionally but you don't know why or is touches you in some place that you cannot discern – you know, this is in general the kind of nature of poetry or the nature of art itself. And I think it's liberatory because, of course, most things, like I've said, want something from you and their intentions are extraordinarily clear, right? And so I do think ambiguity, when we have the capacity to appreciate it, has deep liberatory not only underpinnings in terms of intention, but also can be liberatory in terms of its results with people. So that's why I think it's a useful thing. And certainly one would say that education in its more utopian aspects is, in fact, a deeply ambiguous enterprise, which is learning for learning's sake, right? That you're not simply going to graduate school with an MBA so you can make money, right? Or, versus a trade, I would guess. But that, in fact, it is an open-ended sense of inquiry. The flip side of that, I would say, is only that ambiguity is a power because it's so powerful in getting people's attention and touching them emotionally. The power of ambiguity is often deployed by power itself somehow and certainly the obvious example of that is advertising, that in fact getting your attention, whether it's through humor, through sexuality, through fear, through basic human instincts, is what advertising is extremely good at. And so keeping things, quote-unquote, ambiguous, but then ultimately tying it to selling you is the ongoing quest of advertising. And I think advertising is not just ads on TV. It's the entire show often. You know, it's the logic of advertising is in so many different things. And so ambiguity has a tortured relationship with the powers that be.
It ties heavily into the role of trust that you talk about as well. And, you know, the contrast in ambiguity that you see as from a legal perspective is quite stark. I mean, I teach contracts. And if you're thinking about a contract, generally speaking, a best practice is not only to not be ambiguous, but to do everything in your power to get your intentions in writing. But it's a very different intention and it's a very different purpose. Ambiguity, and I'm this is my question. Ambiguity is powerful, it seems, based upon how I understand your writing, so long as there is a similar level of trust in the artist and in the process. And so what is the role of trust in art and activism, and how does a lack of trust, which I read when we talk about trust, I read it as trust residing in the artist, but right, that is held by the viewer, right, impacting that power?
Trust is such a, you know, we can't, just to say, you cannot speak without trust. Trust is a very important part of our human nature. That is to say, you must, when you say something, you trust that the person at the other end of those words is hearing you and understanding you. It's very basic. And I say that because trust, without trust, you you're in this constant, Ludwig Wittgenstein said, we constantly trust. Like, if we didn't trust, you don't open a door always expecting a hole to open up and you fall into it. You open the door and you walk through because your experience tells you that it's okay to walk through that door. because you've never fallen through a hole before. Think of that as it applies to our everyday lives, because increasingly we find historically that there is a deep erosion in trust in the public writ large. So we suddenly live in a time where, like, not trusting scientists about climate change is entirely possible, because, of course, we all think scientists can get bought off. What's that paper really mean? Statistics are very manipulable. So suddenly the world of empiricism, the Enlightenment, is totally thrown in question because people don't really trust doctors or scientists or politicians, right? And for sometimes very good reason. There's certainly a history of co-optation and manipulation that occurs. But when we lose our ability to trust anything, we lose our ability to communicate. And, you know, just to build it into one example, I loved Occupy Wall Street as a movement. I thought it's, you know, pointing the finger at finance capital was long overdue. And I had a lot of friends involved in it, including myself. That said, it was also a movement based on deep distrust. Deep distrust. And that deep distrust also manifests in the kind of co-workings of the movement itself. And you can certainly start a movement against things, but until you produce some kind of trust between people, you can't get very far. And certainly, I think in the vacuum that is caused by people's deep distrust of each other, power can make a lot of headway while we're arguing with each other.
So can you amplify that a little bit?
Well, so in the space, you know, because I think in some ways, I mean, certainly knowing many activists and even nonprofits working on social justice, there's a million causes. It's so funny. I always think, and it's kind of sad, but I always think to myself, how is it we live in a world where more people, I would suspect, are working on social justice and fighting for good things than ever before historically? And yet, wealth inequity has never been more dramatic. The pairing of these two things is so perverse, right? And I would just say that the machine of capital chugs along. It just chugs along, right? Deregulation keeps kicking in. You're going to keep having these kind of laws that aggregate a lot of wealth to the very small percent. And while everybody's arguing about what tactic best to use or trying to kind of put a hole in the dam, the mechanisms of vast power just pushing forward. And certainly people's movements, which I'm a big fan of historically, just really don't seem to rise up on the scale of things. So I think the trust, and I do attribute it to a cultural phenomena of an attrition of trust. And certainly it also, it will produce, I think, a kind of politics that makes no sense. Because, of course, you are going to get a politics of paranoia. That's what we have today, in not only America, but increasingly in the world, that the baseline for politics is not one of building, but one of deep, destructive desires.
And where
I, oh God, and sorry, how am now. I yeah. such a depressing guy? Because I'm actually quite optimistic about things, I must say. But it is useful. I think the kind of narrative of trust is also useful because, sorry, not to rant too much, but
no, please.
It's just important to me because Americans, particularly in the left, are just deeply cynical. And we take our cynicism as politics. Somehow we confuse the two. And that, you know, cynicism is a reasonable reaction to the world around us, but it is no way to produce good politics.
And, you know, the corollary there in law is bad facts make bad law. And if you make decisions on poor factual scenarios, you tend to not get something that scales well. We are well into, NATO, what I refer to as the unfair portion of the show, where I ask you questions that you lack adequate speaking of time. I've privatized it in my own way by telling you and saying this must be a show that ends at a certain point. And so we have about, and I have about 5 or so minutes left, and I do want to kind of ask your opinion on another recent phenomena, at least from the standpoint of public awareness of it, which is this notion on the speech side, and it includes art, of course, of safe spaces in arenas that otherwise have extolled the sharing of information and unimpeded exchange. Increasingly over the last few months, as I'm sure you've seen, there have been some examples of situations where students and even faculty and staff at universities are protesting perceived civil rights injustices and are seeking the notation of safe spaces, quote unquote, within campuses where they are presumably allowed to express their opinion without opposition. And there has been a debate that has gone on with regard to whether those kinds of safe spaces affect free speech or whether they are an assault on them. Is this part of the critique and trust and even ambiguity issue that you identify and run as a theme through your book, or is it something different?
Well, I do think that there is it's funny because when I think of safe spaces, I do think of, for example, I think of I don't know why my brain goes here, but I was thinking about graffiti walls, mm-hmm. you know, where like the city, in order to combat graffiti, probably like 15 years ago, would produce these like government sanctioned walls where graffiti artists can do whatever they want. And of course, anybody with any sense knows that's the stupidest idea on the planet, because most of the fun of graffiti is being illegal, mm-hmm. right? That's part of the aesthetic. And I think that the trick, of course, with these safe spaces is that they are often produced, quote unquote, by power, or at least what people perceive as power. And in fact, there's not enough trust of those that are producing these safe spaces. Or in fact, let's just say that it feels already pre-designed to co-opt, to somehow get the institution that is hosting it off the hook, that people don't trust them. That said, I do think that it is important to also second guess your dependence on resisting power for the meaning of your art or politics, and that, you know, producing your own safe spaces is a reasonable form of behavior. And also, you know, when it comes to things like, for example, we live in the era of Black Lives Matter and the trans movements, I would just say that, you know, you don't need to be some sort of genius to just acknowledge your own lack of understanding of other people and take a step back and listen to them in these safe spaces. And that I do think that just being aware of white privilege, being aware of capitalism, being aware of patriarchy in a simple way, and just being a little humble in the way you work through the world, is a very useful way to start producing a politics and to not be overwhelmed with it. This is what I mean. It's like sometimes it feels like you can't say anything right, but I think it's okay to stumble your way through the world, but just start taking these ideas seriously and working through them. I think it's okay.
So, Nato, I'm going to give you, and we're chatting with Nato Thompson, author of book Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century. Nato, I'm going to give you 2 minutes as we close the interview to end on a note of optimism, since you alluded to being an optimistic person, if you choose. I'm not asking you to be optimistic. I want to give you the opening because you say that we need patience, compromise, and conviviality, quote unquote, to build a new world. And given your practical focus, you've repeatedly said you don't want to get too theoretical, although you're welcome to, but I appreciate that. Do we have patience, compromise, and conviviality today in the United States, given the rise of demagogues like Donald Trump, who you've mentioned, or even worldwide that you've alluded to? So this is your opportunity. I don't know. Maybe the way I've set it up, it's hard to be optimistic. Maybe we can be. Well, what's your response to that question?
I think there's tremendous hope. You know, as much as everything seems crazy, everywhere I look, in at least the cities I've lived in, there's so many people really dedicated towards taking on race more clearly, taking on power more clearly. Conversations around gentrification are making headway in our cities. I think we've actually evolved our political dialogues in a profound way. And I think that people like Trump often dominate the kind of mental space. But it's important to bear in mind, you know, for example, the Arab Spring was an important movement by young people, kicked off across the Mideast, and Occupy Wall Street, which is not unrelated to the Black Lives Matter movement. has a total spirit of hope and a very profoundly evolved sense of politics. So I think there's all kinds of reasons to be very hopeful. And I do, a lot of folks I know are very interested in not only thinking about these things theoretically, but how to enact them in the cities they live in. And I know that that future is on us, and that I do think operating on a civic level and in our cities that we live is a great way to get these politics across and not just lamenting presidential politics. So I see a lot of hope out there, and I think we can enact them in our neighborhoods, on our street corners, in our public squares, and in the halls of our city governance, no problem. And we should just get out there and do it.
Nate O. Thompson, author of the book Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century. Fascinating read. Thank you for taking time today to kick off 2016 on Hearsay Culture. I appreciate the work you've done. I look forward to staying in touch, and I thank you for taking the time to educate my listeners.
Thanks, David. Thank you so much.
The quarter has just begun on Hearsay Culture. However, I am in the process this week of finalizing the schedule. So rather than go through my usual rundown of the schedule, I'm simply going to say that Hearsay Culture will be, and I don't even know as I'm recording the show on the afternoon of January 11th. I don't know when the show is going to air this quarter, but I know it will air. So it airs at some point every week. But you can get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, or by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I've also made an effort over the last several months to get Hearsay Culture available through the variety of podcasts apps that are out there, from Stitcher on. So you should be able to find it anywhere. If you cannot find it in your favorite podcast app, please do email me at david@hearsayculture.com or go to the contact page and let me know. As I think regular listeners know, Hearsay Culture is by and large a one-man band, and you're speaking to him or you're listening to him. Of course, I have had tremendous help in redesigning the webpage from William Monner and Brandon Fry. Of course, I continue to get, and I am grateful for, help from a variety of DJs and Mark Lawrence at KZSU. The chief engineer for making sure that the show goes on the air on KZSU every week, and from Elena Dolfo at Stanford CIS, who gets the show into the podcast arena. Having said that, though, and I am eternally grateful for these people, because what you have today would not happen but for their efforts, when it comes to everything else on the show, it is me. Why am I saying that? I am saying it because I miss things and because I cannot put in all the time that I would like into the show, and so therefore, I ask for your input and feedback and suggestions, and even, quite frankly, if anyone is interested in volunteering a little bit to help do that kind of maintenance of the website, I would be grateful. Feel free, again, to contact me or go to the interwebs and email me at david@hearsayculture.com. Thank you so much for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.